unlikely to be reversed. Oh, I should say this is unlikely to reverse itself in the sense that 17% of pharmaceutical spending is coming off patent in the next 5 years. And there's not an enormous amount that looks like it's going to be approved that's going to be extremely expensive and widely used. The second sort of structural feature that's gone on is very high cost sharing. Cost sharing has gone up an enormous amount. Basically, in the 1980s and 1990s, firms responded to high health costs by getting rid of people from their plans who they didn't want to cover. In the 2000s, they responded by raising the cost sharing. So you see very high cost sharing. The typical worker in a single plan has a deductible of over $1,000. The typical family has a deductible of maybe 2 to 3 times that. That is more money than the typical family has in the bank. So for the vast bulk of families, a trip to the doctor for an elective expense is going to exhaust what their savings are. That's partly why people, everything that's elective in the healthcare system is actually not increasing as rapidly as it once was. Nobody really forecast that this trend is going to reverse itself. It may stabilize. It looks like it's stabilized a little bit, although the spread of high deductible plans may increase if you believe certain if you believe news stories. But certainly the people don't think this is going to go down. The third factor that seems to be important is efficiency improvements in the provider sector. Basically, we've taken a number of things and put them on the poster as poster children for poor care. And we are starting to penalize them financially. And what we're seeing is reductions in the use of poor care. These are hospital readmission rates, which for the first time in a decade seem to have fallen, and they're falling quite rapidly. These are hospital-acquired infection rates. These are sort of two of the leading items that one thinks about, but there are many more that one could look at. I think about this a little bit like my former PhD graduate school professor Bob Solow once said about the computer revolution in the 1980s. He said you could see the impact of computers everywhere but in the productivity data. And for a number of years, you could see the impact of efficiency everywhere but in the healthcare data. And it finally looked like you're starting to see it. Just to give you one example of this, we probably spend close to $100 billion a year on hospital-acquired infections and unnecessary readmissions. As those things come down, you start to save money. $100 billion a year is a lot, even on a $3 trillion healthcare system. And that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's going on. Forecasting agencies are neither blind nor deaf, and so they see this, but they don't really know what to make of it. So what you see is that for the next few years, current forecasts suggest relatively low growth, but then some reversion to normal trend after that. So the idea is there's no explicit model that underlies it, but it tends to be a sort of cyclical model that suggests that the recession is worse than we thought, and so medical spending is lower than we thought, but that ultimately will come back up to historical norms. As I was saying, it's not my sense that that's the best possible forecast, and I'll show you how I choose to summarize it. But I'm not, obviously this is something that clearly the agencies have struggled with, both the CBO and the actuaries have struggled with, and they've been very open about their difficulty in understanding what's going on. But suffice it to say that that they're probably a bit closer in their forecast to A than to B or to C. The net effect is that if you believe the sort of structural factors are more important, what you suspect is that there will be more in the way of savings coming down the road, anywhere from a few percent up to about 15%, depending on what do you think about the recent growth rate relative to what's going to happen. 15% might be about where you would guess if you thought answer C was right, and maybe 5% might be about what you'd guess somewhere in the 5 to 10% if you thought that answer B was right. This is a lot of money. To put this in perspective, if answer C was right, about one-fifth of the expected deficit in the year 2021 would be eliminated just by the growth of healthcare costs. This is a very big deal. Let me show you what a number of researchers have concluded about this, who've studied this in various different ways. The way that I summarize it, which is milder than my usual summary of things, but try to reflect the uncertainty that I think we all feel, is that there is at least as strong a case for structural changes as for cyclical factors driving the slowdown in cost growth. John Holohan at the Urban Institute suggests that a return to high historic growth rates may not materialize. They're cautiously optimistic. Alterum and the Kaiser Family Foundation, after noting they can explain relatively more because of the recession, still find a fairly big residual on the order of 1% a year reduction in spending. Remember that health costs increase about 1.5% to 2% a year more rapidly than the economy, so 1% is getting you close to Bob Reichauer's magic number of no growth relative to the economy. There are indications that structural changes may be playing a modest role as well. And Mike Chernew and colleagues at Harvard Medical School express cautious optimism, which for Mike is sort of like wild jubilation, may persist. If you then switch to not the rearview mirror, but the fuzzy picture of what's going on and will this continue itself, let me just point out a couple of additional trends that I think are important. And they actually have to do less with federal policy, although it's clear that what the big issue is in federal policy, which is carrying forward the payment and delivery system reforms that are in the Affordable Care Act, since those are many of the things that are driving the efficiency improvements that we've seen. But actually, let me just tee up a little bit of a later discussion, which is a state issue. I've shown you a budget chart for Massachusetts, although I could have put in any state in the country here, which shows you that medical spending has increased and everything else has fallen. And what that means is that there's tremendous pressure to continue in this vein. And as I show you here, it's not just in blue states or even in purple states, but across the country what you're seeing are efforts to address this. And so what's going to happen that will possibly magnify these trends? A few things. One is greater engagement of consumers. People have, if not high deductible health plans, fairly high deductibles. And the thing that they have difficulty doing is figuring out how to use those plans well. So they are facing $1,000 or $1,500, but the question is, how do I spend that money wisely? The thing that people don't have a lot of is information either about which plans are better, which they will hopefully get through exchanges, or about how much different providers cost and their quality, which many folks will get. Massachusetts, we have required insurers by October of this year to be able to tell people in real time what their cost sharing will be for every service they might use at any provider. I don't know whether other states will do that, but the recent effort by CMS to show the prices that hospitals are charging for things and what's going on in states like Massachusetts and in insurance plans that are moving this way suggests that we may not be far from that from that situation. Second is the very big move towards alternative payment systems. You see this in Medicare, where I think the ACO program, both its pioneer version and its shared savings version, is far more popular than people had feared it might be or guessed it would be. You're seeing this in a number of private insurers that are implementing very similar plans. And you're seeing this in provider systems across the country that are deciding that it's time to move from the old-fashioned fee-for-service system into a more of a population management or globally capitated type of arrangement. If we continue that, it will really have enormous implications for how people think about costs. It'll turn the highest cost activities of the medical system from profit centers into cost centers, which would be a massive change in how we think about using different kinds of services. And as I say, the popularity of this kind of model is, I think, surprising in terms of how popular it's been. There are a variety of other things, ranging from data sharing, which is extremely important and unappreciated, but how do you get information to folks who need to use it well? Malpractice reform, a number of states are pursuing this. Administrative simplification, a little bit of which is in the Affordable Care Act, but much more could be done here. The net effect to think about, and Bob sort of laid this out, but I just want to be very precise about it. The net effect to think about is how will healthcare costs rise relative to the economy. The economic growth is generally something that's about 4% a year, and medical spending has generally been about 5.5% to 6% a year. A goal of economists is to say, well, can we make the two of those equal? Notice that tax revenue is roughly going to rise at the growth of the economy. That is, with tax rates constant, the government's going to collect revenue with the growth of the economy. So the question is, will medical spending fall by about 1.5% to 2 points a year? 1.5% to 2 points a year is about what high IT industries grow in productivity at relative to low IT industries. So it's not out of the norm for industries to do that. In Massachusetts, we wrote into law a target to do that, to get to the growth of the economy or even a little bit below that for a number of years. Medicare payments currently, before we do anything about the deficit, are expected to be GDP minus 0.5% over the next decade. So that is a target that is not at all an unreasonable thing to do. I will just end with this, which is, we're not geophysicists studying the movement of the plates on the Earth's crust and just observing them. but we actually influence the way that those that the system evolves and interacts. Policy has and will contribute to this, whether favorably or unfavorably. And so rather than feeling complacent, as my colleague Mike Chernu is wont to do, what I think it suggests is that we think about which policies have been effective and how do we increase the use of those policies, rather than just sit and watch and say we don't really know what to do about it. I'm going to stop here. Thank you very much.
So my job is supposedly to be on the middle of the road, but actually I have one very simple message that I'd like to have as a takeaway, which is that I actually think that focusing on excess cost growth is basically the wrong variable. It's, you know, like we're putting the accent on the wrong syllable. And the variable that I think that we want to be looking at, not just in terms of trying to make these projections for the future, but even in some of our empirical academic research, is the percent of per capita income growth that healthcare is absorbing. I first started doing these numbers actually 15, 20 years ago for actually Bob Helms here in a little article that I called Health or Nothing Else, and I've been sort of following these numbers ever since. So let me tell you where I'm coming from just in the basis of theory and how I see the debate playing out. It seems to me, and I use the term, there's a little article that I did for Altrum, actually mainly in Test Patients Conference, that essentially said what happens, or the subtitle was, what happens when an irresistible force meets an increasingly immovable object. The irresistible force, as I see it, is basically that we still have a healthcare insurance system, private and public, although adapting over time, that basically still has a model where basically when you and I go to the doctor, we bargain over what everybody else will pay, whether we're in a public or a private insurance plan. I think that's the original sin of health insurance. I think it's the cause of the cost growth. And it's not quite the same as saying fee-for-service medicine, because one can actually see a world where if people could still sell, if suppliers could still set prices and they monopolize, and we get away from fee-for-service medicine, they could still actually absorb this growth if there aren't constraints on this issue. And we're not here to have a public policy debate on constraints, but I view the Medicare for All people and the premium support people as basically, if you look closely at their proposal, they're saying we want a universal budget constraint, they're just going to do it different ways. And in the meantime, we're living this world without one. That's the original sin, that's the irresistible force, and I don't see how you ever stop having what we might call excess cost growth until you get at that. But the other aspect here is that often we have these healthcare debates as if healthcare is this world unto itself, and we debate what's going on within healthcare. There is a world outside of healthcare. So for instance, the assumption that excess cost growth in healthcare can be constant over time is not a constancy assumption with respect to the rest of the economy, because as health then becomes higher and higher in terms of its base, that is, it's absorbing an ever-increasing share of the economy, what that means is a constantly declining and eventually negative rate of growth of all the non-healthcare part of the economy. And that's what I call the increasingly immovable object. And the way it plays out, for instance, is if you're an employer and you don't want to reduce cash wages for your employees, and let's suppose you don't have to be all employers, you're just an employer in a failing sector of the economy, one that's not growing, and health costs are going to grow, you've got no growth in what you're selling, but you don't want to get rid of your employees, it's very hard to reduce their cash wages, so you start doing things to react. And states react too. States react in terms of the way that they play out their Medicaid payments. They react by just denying the ability of nursing homes to establish themselves to try to control health costs. So you get these reactions from different parts of the economy. And then what makes all this complicated, and David got into this a little bit at the end of his talk, is the federal government is actually endogenous to all this. So when we look at past projections, we're including projections that include all the healthcare adaptations that the federal government has done over time. Adoption of Medicare, expansion of Medicare, Medicaid expansions, however do you think is going to happen with the ACA. So all that is treated, when we look at past numbers, as the base for which we make projections. And then when we make projections forward, for instance, when the healthcare actuaries make projections forward, they're supposed to make projections forward as if the federal government policy is constant. So you're making projections from a world where federal policy is endogenous to a world where federal policy is exogenous. And that doesn't often make sense. And finally, compounding all this issue is the fact that if the economy itself's growth rate slows, part of that slow growth can be taking place within the healthcare sector. So David's given you some numbers on what's going on in the drug industry. One point of fact, if the drug industry is not being as adaptive or as innovative, that's affecting how innovative the economy as a whole may be.